Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Paul LeClaire, the president of the New York Public Library. I'm delighted to welcome you this evening to the Celeste Bartos Auditorium in the South Court Building, one of the hidden buildings within the New York Public Library, and to welcome you to what is going to be one of the most extraordinary conversations that I think we'll have heard in a very long time. I have the privilege and challenge of introducing two supremely talented and accomplished guests at live from the New York Public Library this evening, Thomas Cahill and Margaret Atwood. It's hard to know where to begin a description of two people who count award-winning writer, poet, journalist, and actor among their myriad accomplishments. But for a library whose core mission is to provide free access to the inspiration of the world's great resources of knowledge and information, both of tonight's participants share an important characteristic. Tom Cahill and Margaret Atwood have both written about the great and complex challenges and ideas of Western civilization in ways that connect with, inspire, and stimulate readers of all ages and of all backgrounds. Thomas Cahill's great Hinges of History series has taken the engaging and moving stories of individuals at pivotal moments in the history of the Western world to explore the highlights, to explore and highlight the roots of our own culture. His use of the very human experiences of periods and peoples from 5th century Ireland to ancient Greece has made bestsellers of historical works of real, authentic depth. The first volume in the series, How the Irish Saved Civilization, hit number 2 in the New York Times bestseller list, as you recall. And the Times has, at different moments, hailed his work as, and I quote, charming and poetic, and quote, persuasive as well as entertaining, and he was recently invited to address the U.S. Congress on the Judeo-Christian roots of moral responsibility in American politics. Must have been very interesting. Maybe you could ask him about that. There will be a question and answer period, and you're invited to use microphones to ask your questions. And I hope somebody does ask that one. His latest work tackles an often poorly understood period of history, the High Middle Ages, which popular culture has tended to alternatively portray as, on the one hand, oppressive and superstitious, or on the other hand, as heroic and glamorous. Mysteries of the Middle Ages looks at some of the surprising and progressive realities of the scientific, artistic, and social rebirth of this period. And, as always, he uses his own cultural characters to draw out enduring messages for all of his readers. Challenging and interpreting these historical insights into today's world will be a woman whose own creative contribution to contemporary literature is second to none. Margaret Atwood has been widely acclaimed as one of the preeminent authors of our time, often using the intensely personal to yield insight into issues of universal concern. Her extraordinary combination of supreme intelligence and natural wit and lyricism make her books compulsively readable and highly popular, as well as intellectually important and enduring, a point clearly illustrated by the 128 different titles, separate titles of her works, that are listed in the collections of this great library. Listing Margaret Atwood's international accolades and awards would take me far over my restricted limit of time this evening, so suffice it to say that as well as being a multi-year nominee and winner of the Man Booker Prize, a French Chevalier des Arts et des Lettres, and a recipient of the Norwegian Order of Literary Merit, she's also been inducted into Canada's Walk of Fame. Her most recent work has generated great excitement among fans and critics alike, being seen as an album of snapshots from her own past. It has already won high praise around the world, with the Times Literary Supplement of London describing each of its stories as, and I quote, a fine testimony of her literary genius, end quote. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you'll agree that tonight's discussion promises to be one of the richest and most exciting from live at the New York Public Library. Following the discussion, as I said, there'll be an opportunity to ask both of our writers and guests this evening questions, and staff will be present to give you a microphone with which you ask your question. And if that all weren't enough, both Tom Cahill and Margaret Atwood will be signing copies of their books outside the main doors of the auditorium this evening when the discussion concludes. And finally, if you enjoy this evening, which I know you will, please sign up, give us your email, to join the mailing list of Live at the New York Public Library. In addition to getting tickets for great events. You are welcome, I'm told, to get 2 free tickets to Daniel Mendelsohn's event, Mass Entertainment and Imperial Politics, here next week on December 5th, as well as 2 free tickets to an event of your choice this coming spring. So without any more words from me, please join me in welcoming 2 of the great writers in the English-speaking world today. Ladies and gentlemen, Thomas Cahill and Margaret Atwood.
Good evening. I'm your interviewer for tonight. And this is the interviewee. These are our roles. I didn't get marooned in Ottawa yesterday. If I had, I wouldn't be here. I had to get away in the middle of the night. I was going to print these questions out so they would look more professional. But as it is, it's my handwriting, and this may cause a few problems. Only 2 people have ever told me I had wonderful handwriting, and one of them was a Japanese person who couldn't read English. And he said, "Your handwriting, it is so beautiful." I said, "What do you mean by it? You mean illegible." Thomas, Mysteries of the Middle Ages. The Middle Ages have gone in and out of fashion. There was a long revival in the 19th century, ranging everywhere from Gothic horror, Monk Lewis's The Monk, to Scott's Ivanhoe, to Tennyson's Idylls of the King, to all of those 19th century Oxford-like university buildings, to the Pre-Raphaelites, to the arts and crafts movement. Then the modernists tossed it all out and jeered at it, much as the 18th century had done. Now it's back with great interest via books about William the Conqueror, whether or not Chaucer was murdered, the Black Death, the Mongol invasions, and as they say, and more. Why are we so fascinated once again?
I'm not really sure, but I think...
Thank you. Next.
I think it has something to do with what we imagine to be the simplicity of the Middle Ages, which I don't think really is simple, but it seems like you have an easier thread through it, for one thing. And also, I think from our perspective, it looks like a lot of fun. You know, they always seem to be singing and dancing and...
murdering each other.
That too, but they did it with great gusto. So, there's something like that in there. You know, one of the things I realized a long time ago was that so many things that contemporary people are attracted to are really medieval under the skin. The Tolkien trilogy, I mean, is basically medieval, even though it's pretending to be something else. It's even true of Star Wars. Star Wars is basically medieval. Why would those writers?
So what you mean by that is magic, monsters, horses.
And yet it's a little. And yet it's not so far away, say, as Greek mythology is. We have some roots there that we don't seem to have anymore in Greek mythology. You don't meet very many people these days who actually pray to Zeus.
More and more, it's coming back.
So I
think you meet a lot of Wiccans, but I guess you would say that Wiccans are basically medieval.
I would actually, yeah. I mean, you see an awful lot of that among the. I would say the writer that most attracted me in the first place to the Middle Ages was Sigrid Undset, who wrote Kristin Lovren's Daughter was her most famous, but she has a bunch of other, 2 other medieval novels. One of them, the one set partly in Iceland. No.
Gunnar.
Sorry, not the Master of Hesfiken.
The one with Gunnar in it.
Gunnar's daughter. Thank you. That was my daughter. Gunnar's daughter, and you see Christianity actually coming in to these northern places, and you see this mixture of paganism and Christianity, and how they're beginning to come together. Well, it's just wonderful and fascinating. It's hard not to find it interesting, because the other part of it, I think, is that the Middle Ages are the first articulation of the modern world. It's the first time that the two great sources that influence us, whether we know it or care or want them to, that is to say the Judeo-Christian and the Greco-Roman, it's the first time that they actually come together and gel so that you can say, well, in medieval civilization you have a kind of Greco-Roman frame and you have Judeo-Christian content, and they are partly warring and fighting with one another and partly getting along. But out of this comes things like the celebration of Christmas, which is both Christian and pagan. It's very obvious, and we're still doing it. So it's hard not to want to be a part of that, because I think it, even to someone who's unreflective, it has something to do with him or her.
Do you read those Brother Kideman murder mysteries?
I tried one, I think.
You didn't like Brother Kideman. How could you not like Brother Kideman?
I don't dislike him. I could always see what was coming next. I like a mystery where I'm completely in the dark and stumped.
I think you just did too much botany. They're botanical mysteries, for those who haven't followed it. Brother Kideman has been on the Crusades and has been a man of the world, but he's retired and become a monk, and now he's doing herbal mysteries. So if a dead body is found, he's the one that finds the leaf on it that means something.
Yeah, I like the television series better with Derek Jacobi. I thought that was terrific.
Okay, well, we'll get off that line of discussion. We'll go on to question 1A and B. Question 1A requires a very short answer. If I'd had your book, would I have slept through medieval history in college the way I did? The answer is no. No.
All right, do I have to say anything?
Yeah, you say no.
No.
No, okay. Thank you. Yes, I wish I had had your book, but instead I had a man who lectured on mills. Mills.
Oh, like mills like the mill on the
around.
Floss, that
yes,
kind of mill?
Yes, those okay. kinds of mills.
Well, I think the problem with so much history writing is that the historian goes toward how different the people of the past are. You know, if you go back, say, to ancient Mesopotamia, people in the Middle Ages did not think the earth was flat, but people in ancient Mesopotamia actually did. They thought it was flat, and they thought that the sky was a kind of dome, just a little bit out of reach. Well, if you try to be an ancient Mesopotamian by thinking that way, and you may be able to do it for a few minutes, but if you do it any longer than that, you're going to get a terrible headache. It just doesn't work for us. But the ancient Mesopotamians told jokes to one another. They wept. They had wonderful parties. They had terrible tragedies. They bled exactly the way we do. The human body hasn't changed. It's gotten a little bigger, but it really hasn't changed. So that we can find communion with them, I think, principally by coming in touch with their emotional lives rather than their intellectual lives, which are so, so very different from ours. And if you do come in contact with their emotional lives, then trying to figure out why they thought the earth was flat becomes a little bit more interesting, I think. That's all I'm doing. I'm not doing anything original. There's nothing in any of my books that constitutes an original theory or an original discovery. Each of the books is based on the middle of the road, the broad middle of the road of current scholarship, whatever it might be. And if I say something a little wacky, I admit that it's my own idea rather than the broad middle of the road consensus of academics. So I'm not really trying to write cutting edge anything. I'm really just trying to pull the reader back into these periods so that you could say finally, now I think I get it. I think I understand what it would have been like to have been there, to have gone through it, to have felt it. So it is the feelings more than anything.
The feeling, yeah. So that would explain why I slept through the mills, because there actually yes. weren't any people in this man's lectures.
No. There was just grain.
Just mills. Yeah, I think it was interested in the economics of it all. I guess that's why. So, and I was not very interested in that. So the other question 1B is also very short.
1B,
it is.
You have to stop doing this.
How much fun was this book to write? Because it reads as if you had a lot of fun.
Yes, I did. I enjoy writing these books. I don't understand that thing about, you know, it's easy to write. All you have to do is sit down at a typewriter and open a vein. I don't get that way of if it's that hard, why don't you do something else? I like what I do. I get a kick out of it. Yes, is it hard? Yes, it's hard. You know.
Is it fun? Yes, it's fun.
But yes, it's fun. It's, you know, I think there's great satisfaction for some people in writing, and for very few. I mean, you shouldn't do it unless you absolutely have to. I do believe that. I mean, when people come up to have books signed afterwards, they'll tell me that they're thinking of becoming a writer. And I always say, I hope there's something else you could be. Besides a writer.
Well, you want to stomp out the competition before people get carried away.
Also, the average writer in the United States makes something like $5,000 a year from his writing. So you could wash dishes and probably make a little bit more than that.
This is a depressing thought. Now I would like, just to cheer us all up a little bit. I would like to give people a bit of flavor of the text by reading this part that I have bookmarked, the beginning of chapter 3, just a couple of pages of text, which is a nice introduction.
Well, chapter 3 is Paris, University of Heavenly Things. The Middle Ages are a great jumble. As I've put my manuscript together, I've sometimes felt I was not so much writing a book as sewing a gigantic quilt full of disparate and even clashing remnants, a large patch of ancient Greece, swatches of late antique and early medieval Rome, oddly conjoined strips from maps both geographical and metaphysical, a not-so-blushing virgin, a blushless queen, and, as we shall soon see, a nun who prides herself on being her lover's whore. What on earth do all these things have to do with one another? But to present the Middle Ages otherwise as a seamless garment would be to falsify their character and leave the reader grasping at a phantasm. A medievalist friend of mine once confided that he often daydreamed of living in medieval times. Of course, there we are, back to the first question. Of course, he added, he always imagined himself a lord of some sort. Sitting in his great hall, being served a side of succulent wild boar from his woodland domains. He never imagined himself the house churl who did the serving or the estate serf who had done the hunting and the butchering. Though distinctions between high and low were less acute then than they are in our world, they were sufficiently stark to steer any dreamer's fancies away from the furrowed farms of Europe and toward its castellated hilltops. What appalls a modern dreamer about the Middle Ages is not so much the distance that lay between peasant and prince as that there was seldom any way of shortening that distance. The peasant would always be a peasant, the prince always a prince. And yet, the rigid stratification of social roles was shaken by the rise of the merchant class, the medieval bourgeoisie. Francis of Assisi's youthful plan to become a great prince was unrealistic because he took no steps to realize it. But had he taken his father's route, he could have become a great merchant prince. As time went on, wealth vied with nobility for political and social power, and wealth won out often enough, especially as independent cities and towns, like Assisi, grew into alternative centers of power. But withal, the trader's route to self-improvement was a slippery one. However difficult it may be to characterize correctly the medieval class system, it's even more difficult to grasp medieval thinking, which was broadly metaphorical and analogical rather than merely logical and rational. The hagiographical stories that clustered around Francis's life, that he preached even to birds who stopped twittering to listen, tamed the ravening wolf of Gubbio, and received in his body the five wounds of the crucified Christ, were probably taken in a non-literal spirit by many of the people who first heard them. Interactions with birds spoke of Francis's instinctive resonance with the natural world, the chastened wolf of his ability to elicit good from even the worst of creatures, the stigmata of his thoroughgoing identification with the sufferings of Christ. Did medieval people think these things had actually happened? They might well have considered such a question beyond answering and would instead, like Frida Kahlo, have invoked the extraordinary beauty of truth. But because we don't think the way they did, we often misunderstand them. In the historian William Manchester, for instance, we find only contempt for all things medieval. And then I quote a little bit about how he saw all these people from the Middle Ages coming into the Renaissance period, hunched, pigeon-toed, like rickets victims, their vacant faces pocked with smallpox, turned blindly toward the future they thought they knew. Gullible, pitiful innocents who were about to be swept up in the most powerful, incomprehensible, irresistible vortex, that is the Renaissance, since Alaric had led his Visigoths and Huns across the Alps, etc. And I say Manchester's libel is peppered with his own unexamined anti-Catholicism, which leads him into one howler after another. He fulminates against an infallible Vatican, seeming not to know that the doctrine of papal infallibility was virtually unknown in the Middle Ages, and that the Vatican did not become the primary papal residence till the Union of Italy in 1870. How he imagines that the Renaissance of the 16th century could have arisen from the starved and shrunken medieval culture he describes, I just don't know. As King Lear said with exquisite medieval logic, nothing will come of nothing.
You've dated the High Middle Ages from 1100 until 1347. Could you explain those dates?
Well, the early Middle Ages, the part that is now still called largely the Dark Ages, and rightly so, is the subject of how the Irish saved civilization, really. And it goes, we could have a conference here with prominent historians, none of whom would agree on the dates. They would just, and we could spend the whole night on that. But I think the easiest way of looking at it is that the Middle Ages begin more or less with the conversion to Christianity of the Emperor Constantine, because things do begin to change. And you could make it a little bit later. You could make it the fall of Rome, which doesn't happen all that much later. And then once you have the fall of Rome, you have the Dark Ages, because you have this period of intense illiteracy when almost all the books were destroyed and lost. And that goes on and on and on. And needless to say, when things like that happen and you have the barbarians coming, the barbarians weren't really invaders. They were immigrants looking for a better place to live. But they do destroy the civilization that was there, because the civilization that was there was unwilling to absorb them rationally.
You think?
Which it could have done had it bothered to do so, but it didn't. And so there were these enormous disjunctions, and that gives us the whole first part of the Middle Ages, or Dark Ages, which finally begins to come to an end as people catch their breath and begin to build cities again. Well, people live a little bit longer. They're not all dying by the age of 15 or 20. And so they begin to plot for the future, and then you have the beginning of cities again. And by the end of the 11th century, you have commerce really getting off the ground and the beginnings of a middle class. So that the 12th century Renaissance, the sort of Renaissance before the Renaissance with a capital R, is based on the new prosperity. and the fact that people can now pay for artists to come and decorate their churches, and they can pay for beautiful clothes, and they can do all sorts of things they couldn't have done in the earlier era. And it is almost always a kind of it's money that sets off culture. I mean, you know, otherwise you have a culture of poverty, which is a very different kind of thing. So you do have this civilizing event taking place that starts with the fact that people have more money and can pay for art and literature. And then, of course, that infects everything. So the High Middle Ages are the 12th, 13th, and first half of the 14th century. Then it unfortunately kind of collapses because in 1347, halfway through the 14th century, the Black Plague arrives. Now, the Black Plague was even in some ways more devastating than the barbarian invasions had been, because in many parts of Europe, a third to half of the populace died. There were towns where there was no one left to bury the dead. They were all dead, and the corpses just piled up. Well, something like that is going to rend any civilization, and that's exactly what happens. I've always thought that Bergman's Seventh Seal gets that period perfectly. You have the old middle, the High Middle Ages is really represented by the company of actors, particularly the visionary, the man who sees things that no one else sees. He is the wonderfully typical medieval figure. He's the sort of St. Francis figure. And he sees that death is stalking the countryside and is coming after people. And he gets his family out of there at just the right time. And then you see in many scenes people stealing from one another, stealing from corpses, a disintegration of society that, of course, occurs in something like that. The only character in that movie that I think is not quite right is the knight, who's just too Lutheran.
Well, there are some pretty Lutheran figures in all of that. The flagellants come through in that movie.
Well, yeah, they're accurate, but I don't think that the knight who worries about whether God exists and how he fits into the scheme of things is a very Reformation figure. You know, he's Bergman. You know, he's the kid who grew up in a Lutheran household and is still bothered by the whole thing. So he makes him into the knight, and it's an interesting way of doing it. But he doesn't quite fit. You know, you would be hard to find that guy in the mid 14th century. I think someone quite that articulate about whether or not he believes in God. Everyone still believed in God. You know, you don't find that till after the breakdown of Europe into warring religious patterns.
I read it more as he wants proof. He wants somebody to turn up who has seen either the devil or God. And although he himself is playing chess with death, he wants something over and beyond that. The playing chess with death was an old medieval theme.
Yes.
It's not only Bergman.
No, and there are many things in that movie that are, you know, the dance of death over the hills.
Loved that.
That's a medieval image. It's just that I don't, it's hard to find a real non-believer in the Middle Ages.
Didn't look hard enough.
There are plenty of them after that, but not then, you know.
My next question has to do with women. You have some great sections connecting such figures as Hildegard of Bingen, the original Nunzilla, and a formidable creature. Have you ever seen the Nunzilla that you can get in the... Do you know what Nunzilla is?
No, okay, but I thought you just made it up.
I thought you were
being very clever.
No, it's a wind-up figure that's about this big, and it's a nun carrying a ruler, and you wind it up, and it walks across the table, and sparks come out of its mouth. I think you need
Does it hit you over the knuckles with the ruler?
Well, that's what the ruler is for. Yes. Anyway, she is the original Nunzilla and a formidable creature, but she is not alone. For instance, think of St. Teresa and St. Julian of Norwich, these formidable abbesses and mothers superior who ran these institutions with wills of iron and got to see visions too, as well, and probably wouldn't have run them.
Well, Hildegard had a vision whenever she needed one.
Well, so did Julian of Norwich, as far as I can tell. I mean, I think it was necessary to have this ability. But also you had to be very good with sums. You had to be very good with numbers in order to run your institution. So you've connected all of this with the rise of the cult of the Virgin Mary, who hadn't been a big deal earlier, and also with the courtly love convention. So let me start you off by asking a question I've always wanted answers. Where did nuns come from?
I actually was trying very hard to answer that question all through that chapter myself. Where does the idea of celibacy come from, or you know that we will never have sex? I don't know whether that's what you're really talking about, but that's certainly part of it.
Well, where did the sort of this very institutionalized thing?
Well, it comes from a bunch of...
Where did it come from? For instance, the Vestal Virgins in Rome. Were there earlier sort of pre-Christian consecrated virginal people? There were certainly men who mutilated themselves in interesting ways for the benefit of pagan goddesses. But where did this nun thing come from?
Well, I think you can push it back as far as Pythagoras. These communities in ancient Greece were very much like monasteries. And I think, though I can't prove it absolutely, that all comes from the East, that it comes from Hindu and Buddhist monasticism, and it comes over, because there are so many things at Pythagoras that to me look like things that were going on in India, and I think we've just lost the connection. So I think if you really want to push it back, I think you end up with the Buddha probably. But you had all through the Greek centuries, the later Greek centuries, not in Homer, but in from say the time of Plato on, you have this rewarding of the bachelor, the man who doesn't procreate, and of course we know about the Vestal Virgins. They were not, I would hardly say they were rewarded, but they were a part of society. They had a recognized role, and you have running all through Greek philosophy this despising of the flesh. You can't miss it in Plato, and then in someone like Plotinus. I mean, he just hits you over the head with it constantly, insofar as you could say that Plotinus hits anyone over the head with anything, but. So there's that on the one side, and then you have the example of Jesus in the New Testament, who seems to be celibate. Of course, he has a very short life. He's probably dead by the time he's 30. That example was combined with the Greco-Roman vocabulary. Anything new is received into the old, and what the Greeks and Romans had was this vocabulary that enabled them to, in some sense, despise the flesh, and that gave a vocabulary to intellectual Christianity, so that you have the fathers of the church in the early centuries sounding very, very like Plato, and worse. And I think out of that comes this... positioning of virginity. And that all sounds pretty awful, but luckily the humanizing of it really takes place in the cult of the Virgin Mary. Yes, she's a virgin, but that's not how she appears in art. She appears as a mother, And in fact, she's usually breastfeeding her child. In the early images, that's what she's doing. So you have this very big change. It's almost like it goes into a different gear altogether, because the chastity of people like Plato was in many ways sheer snobbery. I'm better than you are. I don't need that. You know that, and the Greeks and the Romans were incredible snobs. You have to notice that as you read this stuff. But there's nothing snobbish about a woman breastfeeding a child. It's the most ordinary work in ancient civilization or in modern civilization. What could be more ordinary, more daily, more quotidian than a woman feeding a child? So it switches into something else, and you get, though it remains that you have nuns, you begin to have nuns who are not just icons off by themselves. They start interacting with the populace. They start doing things like Hildegard of Bingen, who supposedly, this is a typical medieval thing. She was a cloistered nun. That means she wasn't supposed to go anywhere or see anyone. She traveled everywhere. She gave speeches to overflow audiences in one cathedral after another, up and down the Rhineland and over into France. She couldn't be stopped, you know, but she was a cloistered nun. She wrote one book after another. She has a treatise on the fish of the Rhineland, you know. And you think, well, you know, she has it all right. She has all the different kinds of fish, and they're all, you know. And you say, either she did an awful lot of fishing herself, or she talked to an awful lot of fishermen. You know, so she's interacting with people all over the place, but she's a cloistered nun. You know, there's a real change going on. It doesn't completely explain virginity, because I'm not sure anything does. But it helps to give it some roundness, some perspective.
Do you think that the rise of powerful women figures, whether somebody like Hildegard, the Virgin Mary, etc., do you think this comes from the Celtic tradition rather than the Greeks and Romans? And would you hold it all with Robert Graves and his writing about a pre-classical Greek great mother figure? Would you connect that way back to Isis and Osiris? How far laterally and how far back in time would you make those connections?
I think Robert Graves is crazy, but I think he's wonderfully crazy. I mean, I think everyone
People can be right,
yeah, right.
About some things.
Like Nietzsche, and some things. But I think everyone should read The White Goddess, but then you also have to put it in some kind of context. But I'm not sure that these female figures could have got off the ground if they had been confined to the Greco-Roman world. They don't get off the ground in the same way, for instance, in Greek Orthodoxy, as they do in the medieval Latin West. And I think the reason for that has partly to do with Celtic and Germanic models. Women in Celtic and Germanic societies, pagan societies, had much. They were not equal to men, but boy, they had a lot more clout than they ever did in the Greco-Roman world. So I do think that is part of the mix. Because what you have is, once Gregory the Great and his fellow bishops admit the barbarians as they are, you know, they don't try to remake them from the ground up. They say, no, you can keep your Christmas your winter customs, whatever the hell you call them, and you can keep your, you know, you can have the same booze that you've always. We don't mind. It's all right. You know, you just have to. We're just going to Christianize this. But they let all of that stuff in, and once they let that in, you get an enormous diversity. I mean, think of Europe is such a small place when you come right down to it, compared to other continents. But it's full of all of these things that, you know, you can't, you go from one tiny French village to the next French village, and they make a completely different cheese in the second village than they make in the first one. And they wouldn't think of eating the cheese from the first village. And the people in the first village feel exactly the same way about that. I mean, just, you know, that kind of stuff where you get all of this amazing diversity really comes out of the admitting of the barbarians into Christianity.
So can you connect the rise of the Virgin Mary with the Easter Bunny for,
yes,
for 10 points?
Well, Easter is the name of the Saxon goddess of springtime. It has, yes, nothing to do with Christ or the resurrection originally. And she came along about at the time when Jesus rose from the dead, you know, about that time of year. And she had
eggs.
Rabbits and eggs.
Eggs,
yeah,
yes,
you bet. Those were her, the things that came along with her. So that's why we have rabbits and eggs, and that's why we call it Easter. A number of times in Italy, I've explained to friends of mine, they say, what is this Easter? You know, because they call it the day of the resurrection, you know.
They don't call it the day of the eggs.
No.
No.
And I say, well, Easter is the Saxon goddess of springtime. And they can't figure it out.
Well, the
weirdest
thing I heard from Italian rural superstitions and festivals is that apparently at Christmas time in some parts of Sicily, it's not Santa Claus who brings the presents. It's your dead grandparents. How much fun is that?
La familia. You can never get away from it.
Well, I said, to the person who told me this, I said, aren't the kids scared? And they said, no, they're not scared. It's the way of making, you know, it's of making the dead grandparents not scary.
Well, in most of Italy, it's a witch who brings the presents, you know, Befana.
Yes, but in some places.
And she's a very nice, you know, she's ugly and old, and she's a very nice witch.
Well, basically, your dead grandparents.
Yeah, it's not the right. So.
Now, let's switch to non-nun types of women and go to Eleanor of Aquitaine and the courtly love convention. So my question would be, was courtly love a way of placing love above sex, thus complementing the sex without love that was the usual lot of medieval women, especially if aristocratic? In other words, they were put into arranged marriages in order to cement alliances. You weren't expected particularly to love your husband, but you could listen to the songs, courtships, flatteries, pleadings, whinings, and weepings of men in your court.
Yes, and when no one was looking, you could invite one of them into your bedroom. So it's not just about love.
Do you think that happened?
I mean, it's not love without sex. Anyway.
But it was supposed to be love.
Yeah.
Yeah. You sound dubious.
I am. because I think that, well, this comes, I think the courtly love tradition basically comes out of two completely different things that somehow meld together. One is the image of the Virgin Mary, which has suddenly we have a woman at the center of the civilization. Nothing like that had ever happened before. She's everywhere. Then you have all these castles in which you have the lord of the manor, the lady of the manor. And who are the women? Well, her maids-in-waiting and maybe a daughter or two or something like that. Those are the women. How many men are there? 50, 100.
How old are they?
They're the knights.
Yes.
And they're in their 20s, and they're hanging around the castle. They're waiting for the next war so that they can fight for the lord. Well, what do they do in the meanwhile? After they've played 1,000 rounds of chess, after they've had these melees and, you know, joustings and all that, what do they do? Well, what you end up, you know, men, idle men invent games, always. And the game becomes...
Golf. No. That's right.
<Sorry. laughs> Only in a later and less vigorous civilization. It becomes, who is man enough to woo the lady of
get
the manor?
Get a little white ball into the hole.
Well, it's one way of looking at it.
He's never going to forgive me.
I do, I forgive you. It's all right. I think a lot of what happens in the courtly love tradition starts with idleness. People, you know, guys just say, well, you know, what do we do now?
I'm very disappointed to hear that. I thought you were going to say because of the overweening beauty, grace, intelligence,
that too, of course,
charisma, and wardrobes of these women, that they were irresistible. I thought you were going to say that.
I wasn't. But but I do think that you have a rise at the same time. Again, you have both men and women who have leisure for the first time. What are the women reading? They're reading Ovid. They're reading Catullus. They're thinking about how wonderful it would be to have an affair instead of being stuck with this guy that their parents picked out for them, who's really a kind of a bore and, you know, gets drunk every night and isn't interested in them. And there's this guy that goes by on a horse every once in a while, you know? And so by reading Ovid and Catullus, they also learned that there are ways of doing this. There are ways of going about it, that there's a whole, and they begin to develop this whole language of courtly love. So that you, at that time, for instance, you have things like napkins, and a little bit later, forks coming into play. They had never done anything. There were no napkins. There were no forks, you know. Everybody had a knife, and you sort of cut the thing open, and then you ate it, you know. And you didn't need a napkin because you just sort of had it all over your face. And there were dogs under the table. So you have, you start having this sense of refinement for the first time that had never existed before. You have, for the very first time in human history, heterosexual dancing. Before that, men had always danced with men and women with women. And this dancing mimics the whole procedure of courtly love. You know, madam, would you like, may I, you know, all of, you know, there's a way of doing it, there's a way of inviting her onto the floor, there's a way of her first not being sure that she would like to, and then, you know, it all goes on like that. And it has one step after another, after another, after another. It all starts with things like the art of loving by Ovid, but then the medieval start writing their own little, you know, you have self-help books galore all of a sudden for the men and for the women, how to go about this. And so it becomes a whole new way.
How do they stand up today?
Well, they're extremely...
I mean, would they be of any help? No.
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 I don't think so. I don't think those ladies on Sex and the City would find them in.
Well, but for other ladies.
Even for other ladies, I think it's kind of... For one thing, it's extremely earnest. Whereas Ovid is funny, because Ovid is really making fun of all this stuff. These medieval how-to books are very earnest. They're trying to tell you how to go about it. And there don't seem to be any jokes in there. They really want you to. So it, you know, it's it was the very tail end of the tradition is Keats's the Eve of St. Agnes. I mean, that's when you get, you know, and that's completely serious. There are no jokes in the Eve of St. Agnes.
No, not. No.
And, but that's the
voyeurism, but no jokes.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, ah, bitter cold it was.
No, stop right there. was Eleanor of Aquitaine, who is your central figure in this section, really as powerful, complex, and wonderful as Katharine Hepburn made her in The Lion in Winter?
Well, Catherine Hepburn was the perfect person to play Eleanor of Aquitaine at that stage of her life, that's for sure. And I think that's what Eleanor was like. She had
at
that
the end,
hauteur,
yes.
And knowing what she wanted, knowing what she thought, you know, she was not in the dark. She has a very long life. She only dies at the age of 82, which is an incredible age for any medieval person, especially one who had given birth to 10 children.
Yes.
It's amazing that what she saw. And she changes over the course of her life. I mean, she's a very interesting figure at the age of 15, I think. But by the time she dies, she has learned so much about life and about what's possible and what's not possible. She becomes an extremely generous old woman, whereas as a young woman, she was willful and wanted her own way. Why not?
Very tall.
Yes. Well, it's wonderful to see. I went to Fromfroid Abbey in the Loire Valley, and she's there. I mean, there's a picture of her in here, but she's there right next to Henry II there, and at the feet of Henry II is Richard the Lionhearted, who wished to be buried at the feet of his father because he had betrayed him on an earlier occasion. So it's all laid out there. Well, you look at it and you say, it's obvious that these figures were made. Richard was made by somebody else, but that Eleanor and Henry were made by the same artist. And Eleanor is taller than Henry, and Richard was 6.5 feet tall. So she was the source of his great height. Mm-hmm. So she must have been amazing in her time, to have stood up in a court. And she always got tremendous response from her own vassals. She was the Duchess of Aquitaine, Poitou, Gascony, and a bunch of other places. I mean, she ruled over more of France than the King of France did, over more of present day France. And you can see how she got away with it. Partly, it was
because
height.
She was tall. Yes, exactly. I think it would have been quite different if she'd been a little tiny person.
Yeah.
We just got room for one more question.
Is that right?
I think so. Yeah. Didn't you say one? So I'll skip over the one where I say, was it too bad for American women that the Puritans kicked out the Virgin and the female saints and then founded America?
All right, we won't
so
do
we
that.
So we won't do that. The answer is probably yes.
and it's a complicated issue.
It's a complicated
issue. It'll be dealt
with
in the next volume.
Yeah, well, what happens with the Puritans is that everything becomes very male. Very male. Away go all of those female saints and the Virgin Mary, and no more girls. Away they go. And it's at that
Well, the more aggressive a society is, the more bellicose, the more male it is almost certainly likely to be, I think.
Well, they started off founding America. And it took people a long time after that to get to Smith College. You know, it just took them a long time.
She's Canadian.
You think it didn't take... What do you mean by that?
They understood.
They understood. Okay. Yes. Well, being Canadian, I came down to the States in the early 60s and announced gleefully that I was going to be a writer, and all my American women friends looked at me askance and they said, oh, how would you dare to do that? You know, they really, it really was like that. They were scared of doing anything so abrupt.
Yeah, but you grew up in a forest, didn't you?
Yeah, but so did a lot of Canadians. So my last question is, you have some harsh or else very frank things to say about the United States Catholic Church and its cover-up of child abuse by priests and bishops. How has this cover-up damaged believing Catholics? How hurtful has it been to them?
I think it has largely destroyed the Catholic Church in the United States. I mean, there may be people still attending churches, but if you go into most churches, it's gray and bald heads.
Do you think it has destroyed belief or merely church attendance?
Initially, I don't think it does destroy belief, but I think it does destroy the fabric of the society. Yeah. What happens in the end? Where do those people go when they say, I can't do this anymore? Well, some of them are going to go to other Christian churches. Some of them will stay home. Some of them will. I mean, there are all sorts of reactions, but it is nonetheless a societal rending that the bishops are obviously incapable of addressing, I think. And it is they that I blame much more than I do the pedophiles. It is the cover-up that is worse than the pedophilia. The pedophilia is bad enough, but the cover-up is worse, and the bishops do not see what they have done. They are incapable of looking at themselves honestly, I'm afraid. I think they are a bad lot. They were appointed by John Paul II largely because they agreed with him on about 10 or 12 issues that it's almost impossible for anyone to agree on, at least all of them, you know, mm-hmm. birth control.
So, if you were Dante, you would put them in the inferno.
Yeah, I think that's where they're going.
And with that, we will know.
Before the first question, I wanted to read just a brief paragraph from Margaret Atwood's Negotiating with the Dead, A Writer on Writing, which is a wonderful collection of essays, and I think it's a good way of framing what's happened this evening. There's an epigram tacked to my office bulletin board, pinched from a magazine. Wanting to meet an author because you like his work is like wanting to meet a duck because you like pate. That's a light enough comment upon the disappointment of encountering the famous or even the moderately well-known. They are always shorter and older and more ordinary than you expected. But there's a more sinister way of looking at it as well. In order for the pâté to be made and then eaten, the duck must be first killed. And who is it that does the killing?
As your interviewer of the evening, I will now ask you to come forth with some questions that you would like to ask.
There's
Thomas.
A lady standing there who has a microphone, right? And there's somebody, and there's a guy over there. Okay.
There's one right there. Good.
I just want to say that nursing is not, it may be a daily experience, but it is quite out of the ordinary in every other way. It's a peak experience for most women who've tried it. And
I didn't mean that it wasn't.
I think he meant by ordinary,
something you see everywhere.
Common.
An observable sight.
Yes.
Not something up in the heavens.
Yes, I think that the image of the mother nursing the child is an image of a peak experience. But anyway, I wanted to ask more about Eleanor of Aquitaine. How would you say that she exerted her authority other than through her height?
Oh, well, I mean, she was duchess, she was queen of two different countries.
She was very smart.
She exerted it by being queen. It's hard to ignore a queen.
But she was also very educated. Her funeral effigy has her holding a book. And at a time when almost nobody could read, and particularly almost no women, she was unusually well educated.
Yeah. Okay. So finish
college, all you You haven't done something.
Can you? There's a lady standing there.
Thank you. First of all, I must confess I haven't read your book, so if you've covered this in your book, I'll find it out. Humor is such a huge part of our culture. All of our television is humorous, our theaters are humorous. Unfortunately, that's not something that we read in the history books, though. So my question is twofold. What would a medieval person have found funny? What kind of humor did he have? And is our obsession with humor modern, or do we somehow just, did it not survive in our history books from ancient civilizations?
Well, there are very few things that age more quickly than jokes. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the problem is that it's not that there weren't jokes or that there wasn't humor in earlier civilizations. There was. It's just that it's hard for us to find it funny. Even something as relatively recent as Shakespeare's comedies are hard to stage and have the rollicking effect that they once had. I mean, already that's, which is only, what, 5 centuries ago, is already too old for us in many ways, unless you have a really brilliant director doing it. But, I mean, I find, you know, there's humor in the book of Genesis. When God and his two angels come and visit Abraham, and Sarah is listening at the door to the tent, and God says, I will come back in a year's time and you're going to have a child. They're both very old people. And, you know, Sarah standing there, she starts laughing. You know, she says, yeah, I mean, it's basically, she says, yeah, sure. I mean, it's right there. It's in the text of the Bible. Now, that's about almost four millennia old. You know, it's still a good joke, actually. Even though
the joke's on her.
Yeah. Well, as it very often is for anybody, you know. You know, you have a wonderful instance in about 8th century, I guess it would be the John Scotus Erugena sitting with the emperor, and they're drinking away, and the emperor says, "Well, what's the difference between an Irishman?" John Scotus Erugena was an Irishman. "What's the difference between an Irishman and an idiot?" And Scotus Erugena says, "Just the table." That's still funny. So, yeah.
I think it's impossible to find a culture devoid of jokes. You know, I think it's very built into human nature. Chimpanzees make jokes, believe it or not, and find things funny. So I think a lot of it was the same kind of humor that you find all around you today, except the wording was different. So there would be a certain number of mother-in-law jokes, a certain number of toilet jokes, a lot of sex jokes there are in every culture that we know anything about, and a lot of slipping on a banana peel jokes. You know, slapstick and silly things like that seem to be pretty universal.
Yes, someone here in the front.
I was just thinking, with regard to humor, the buffoon and the clown were really recognized traditional figures that go all the way back to the Greeks and the Romans, you know, and there is a certain kinds of, you know, certain days of the year when the so-called Feast of Fools, where, you know, the upper class changed places with the lower class and had a lot of fun. Yeah,
down.
Everything is turned upside down so everybody can have a good time and let off steam. I mean, it's certainly in Ireland, there was a connection between the clown, the fool, and the poet.
Yeah.
So that was part of what was expected. In the 12th century, there were marvelous satires written where in the, the poets took on the clergy, you know, and the clergy responded in kind. I mean, they were very clever and very funny and very extensive, and certainly I should also say, there was a, I'm thinking of some of the differences. I mean, the humor was probably crueler.
Can be pretty cruel today.
Well,
but the buffoon was a much more crude figure than you could get away with, you know, say on Comedy Central. Except occasionally. So that's all I wanted to say.
All right, that was Dr. Maureen Waters, who's written a history of comedy, of humor.
You mentioned how the Black Plague devastated Europe. Where do the Crusades fit into this picture, where if Europe is devastated, they're still trying to go into Asia and conquer Palestine? Or did the Black Death end the Crusades?
Well, there are five major Crusades. They all take place before the advent of the Black Death. There are, you know, the word then, of course, enters the language, many languages, as it entered the language of our president a few years ago when he called what he was doing in Iraq a crusade. He didn't do that again, but so that lots of things are called crusades. You know, there are a lot of things later on that get to be called crusades, but the trying to win back the cities of the Holy Land from Islam took place over five crusades, from the 12th through the early 13th century, and then that's basically the end of it. Only the first crusade was successful. The other four were all abysmal failures. How about, there are people here in the middle. And then I think we should get on our way because we have a dinner waiting for us.
Oh, I was going to say because art is long and life is short.
Yeah, that's much better.
I was just curious how the last question about the Catholic Church related to the book, because I hadn't read it. Was there more context there?
This is the sort of thing where I can't explain it unless you read the book, because it's about the Catholic Middle Ages. Okay. So it ends with a critique of the current situation in Catholicism, which I think by that point is on the minds of every reader. And to not deal with it, I think, would be to shirk my responsibility. But to actually go through it, that's a question that can only be answered by reading the book.
Pages,
how about one more? And
314, 315, 316, and 317 will do it for you nicely.
this question is off the subject, and maybe you don't want to answer it. This has been such a delightful exchange between the two of you, and I'm sitting here thinking, did you know each other before? And did you rehearse this? Or what is the status of your relationship before you entered the door?
My wife sitting over
yes.
there.
We have inter-emailed before. We have inter-emailed and conversed upon the telephone, but we had never actually met before this evening. So that is the status of our relationship. I am shorter and older than he thought I was going to be.
All right. Thank you very much.